Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom of Space. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host here on the Gist of Freedom, brought to you by our producer, Leslie Gist, historian and author. Our guest tonight is Dr. Bradley Skelcher, associate provost and a professor of history at the Delaware State University in Dover, Delaware. Professor Bradley was honored in 2008 at the Freedom Banquet of the NAACP. He's also studied at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Professor
How are
Bradley
you?
Skelcher. Fine. How are you? I want to start off. I got a question right up front here. Was Delaware State University, is that an HBCU, historically black college and university?
Yes, it is. We're an 1890 land grant established.
Okay, 1890.
With the 1890 land grant. There's 17 plus Tuskegee that are included in the 1890 land grants, and we're all historically black colleges and universities.
Okay, and you've been in business since
1890. That was when the act was passed to establish the 1890s. That's where we're called 1890s. We were chartered in 1891.
Okay. Well, tonight we're going to talk about the Exodusters, and along with other topics, in general, the American colonization movement and the movement of African Americans out of the continental United States to all points west and Africa and Nova Scotia and such. And I understand, Doctor, this movement started in 1787?
I think that we can safely say it started when Africans were first brought to the shores of America. Enslaved Africans, that is, when they were first brought here against their will, they immediately started looking for ways back to Africa. And short of that, look for ways of creating African settlements in the Americas. So I think we can safely say from if we're looking at the English colonies, we can say immediately upon arrival on the shores of America, enslaved Africans who were brought here against their will look to go back to Africa or create Africa in America.
I see. Was Thomas Peters founded the Sierra Leone Company? Was that the first company that we have documentation on?
Yes, in 1787. Thomas Peters, along with many other African Americans, joined the British Army and Navy to fight against the American independence movement. They were given their freedom by the British to if they ran away from their plantations, if they would run away from slavery and join the British military, they were promised their freedom, and we think estimated about 20,000 African Americans ran away from their American colonists who were fighting for the independence from Great Britain.
And those American colonists were slaveholders.
Oh yes, slavery existed in every American colony, and many of those, roughly a third of the American colonists joined the independence movement, the revolution against the British, and about we can safely say about a third remained loyal, and the rest were not on one side or the other. The British, in a war effort, promised freedom to any American slave who ran away from any revolutionary to join their cause, and about 20,000 did.
And some of those go ahead.
They were called Black Loyalists. And after the Revolution, of course, the British lost the war and granted independence to the American colonies. And so what happened to the Black Loyalists? Many were evacuated to Nova Scotia, including Thomas Peters. And if you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I have visited Nova Scotia. It's a beautiful place, but it's not real friendly in the wintertime, and it's very rocky, and the soil's not real good to till. So we had Black Loyalists at Nova Scotia who were not accustomed to those rugged conditions, immediately sought some avenue to go back to Africa. And together with some British abolitionists, they formed the Sierra Leone Company. The British government secured land in West Africa, which is present-day Sierra Leone. And about 1,000 Black Loyalists left Nova Scotia to go to Sierra Leone. So we see that as the predecessor of the latter American Colonization Society, founded in 1816 in the United States, which led to the formation of the Colony of Liberia.
Let me ask, are there any descendants there still in Nova Scotia? Those Black Loyalists that were sent there, are they still have any descendants there?
As far as I know, I don't believe so. There are some Black Loyalists that relocated to New Brunswick, and many remained in New Brunswick, Canada. And many of the Black Loyalists who migrated to New Brunswick later joined the Royal Marines during the War of 1812, and actually fought against the United States again in what was called the Second War of Independence. And like in the American Revolution during the War of 1812, the British also promised freedom to enslaved African Americans in the Chesapeake region, and we think about 500 ran away and joined the British Navy at Algiers Island in the Chesapeake, which is part of Virginia, and fought in the Royal Marine Corps, and that was about 150 years before the United States Marines allowed African Americans to join, and that occurred in 1942 during the World War II.
Who was Paul Cuffey, and what was his role in the movement?
Paul Cuffey was a merchant from Boston. He also was a member of Wilmington, Delaware's Quaker meeting. The Quaker meeting in Wilmington. So he was also a member of that meeting. There are a lot of ties between Delaware and New England, by the way. He had a merchant company and owned several. He was African American too, and owned several ships and navigated the Atlantic, taking trade items to England, and learned of the Sierra Leone Company, and started transporting free African Americans to Sierra Leone. Later, this idea was picked up by many white Americans, and to create the American Colonization Society to transport free African Americans back to Africa and Liberia in particular.
Now, what was the name of that association? That association was out of Washington, D.C.?
There were American Colonization Societies located throughout the United States. There was one in Wilmington, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Virginia. There are several of these colonization societies. And really formed with the nefarious idea of transporting free African Americans back to Africa, because there was a fear that they would have an undue influence on enslaved Africans. So you had people like Senator Clay from Kentucky involved in this, and several prominent white leaders. As a matter of fact, Richard Allen refused to endorse any of the American Colonization Society attempts to transport free African Americans back to Africa, because he said, this is our country, we're going to stay here and also reap the benefits of American society.
Was any of Paul Coffey's ships confiscated? And what about Martha's Vineyard? Is that where he lived, or was he from that area?
Yes. I'm not aware of any of his ships being confiscated offhand. That may have well happened. I'm just not aware of that.
Okay.
And also, must say that Martha Vineyard, Boston, Cape Cod, New Bedford, Nantucket Island, these all had significant African American populations, and they were seafarers. Some were whalers, captained by African American captains with all black crews. As a matter of fact, if I know most of the listeners are familiar with Moby Dick. Those ships, the ships that he, the first place he went, first opening pages were in New Brunswick visiting a black church, and the harpooners on the whaling ship that was the focus of Moby Dick. Those were African American harpooners, and so if you read the novel very closely, it's telling a story of black mariners in many respects, because they were the ones going out on these ships, and participating in this lucrative business of whaling.
Could you explain to our listeners what is a whaler? How do they make their money? How did they make their money?
In those days, they would go out, typically out of Massachusetts, and they would follow various whales, like what were called right whales. They were the right whales to harpoon, and they harpoon these, and then they bring the whales on board and render them down to oil. And the whale oil was used to light houses, and that was primary fuel for lighting in those days. And there were various other uses for them, but they're primarily for whale oil for lighting purposes. And these ships would navigate virtually around the world, and so you see cases of mariners on these whale ships in the Indian Ocean, in the far East, as the whale populations diminished from over whaling, they would have to go further and further out. So some of these ships would be out for a couple of years, and it also exposed the mariners to new worlds and new ideas, and African Americans were there seeing the potential and possibilities of what the world was about, and brought these stories back to America. So you wonder how Pap Singleton knew about places like Cyprus in the Mediterranean. Well, you know, he was exposed to a lot of stories and knew the potential of what was out there. As a matter of fact, when many of the Western settlements failed that he was a part of, or weren't quite as successful as he hoped, he looked to take African Americans to the island of Cyprus. And he knew that Africans had been brought to Cyprus to work the sugar plantations in 2,000 years ago.
Okay, let me ask something there,
Professor. Sugar plantations were first being started. He knew about that. And
excuse me, Professor.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, excuse me a minute. Now, you mentioned Benjamin Singleton. Was he also a whaler, and was Crispus Attucks engaged in that business as well?
Benjamin Pap Singleton, Pap was his nickname, was not, as far as I know, had not been near the sea, was enslaved in Tennessee, escaped to Canada, and then eventually made his way to Detroit, during the Civil War, went to Tennessee to help the newly freed African Americans to, you know, find settlements further points west. That's the incredible part about Pap Singleton. How did he know all of this? And it's a matter of people talking and telling stories and mariners bringing these stories back and then just flowing through the communications network into plantations or free African American communities in the North. An incredible communication system. Crispus Attucks did work in the maritime industries. He was sporadically employed, which many people in Boston at the time were underemployed, so to speak, as a result of the boycotts against British trade that was happening in Boston at the time. And when Crispus Attucks, like his fellow workers, and many worked the docks, many were longshoremen, stevedores, and worked the ships. Many of them lost their jobs because of British policies towards helping out the British East India Company and their tea trade, and which put a lot of shippers out of business, including John Hancock. They were upset, and they saw the British policies were putting them out of work. And so Crispus Attucks led, by all measures, that protest against the British and started, you know, hurling insults and such at the British soldiers, which led them to provoke them to shoot back. And Crispus Attucks was the first to die for American freedom, an African American.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's an incredible story that unfolds with the African American experience during this period, and the incredible movement that many led to find peace and solitude and freedom. If not in Africa, but someplace in America.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they were seeking new territory within America.
Yes.
I'm
sorry.
No, go ahead.
When we initially started, I was talking about that. When did this begin? Well, we can say it began with the first Africans arriving. We have a place in South Carolina called Igbo Landing. The Gullah and Geechee peoples there, the African peoples there that speak Gullah in various other African versions of African languages on the coastal islands near Charleston, South Carolina. There's a place called Igbo Landing where a group of Igbo were brought to America, enslaved and brought to America, and they landed at Igbo Landing. They were Igbo from the Nigeria, what's present-day mm-hmm. Nigeria. When they arrived, they immediately they drowned. They drowned themselves. They started walking back to Africa, and they went in the water and drowned themselves. They were immediately looking to go back to Africa, and to them, that wasn't suicide. That was an escape. And it's so important to understand that amongst many of West Africans that your body may die, but your spirit lives on. And your ancestral spirits are with you every day. And so to the Igbo, this was not killing themselves. This was going back to Africa, if not their bodies, their spirits. The Stono Rebellion in 1739, was led by I believe Akan, Ashanti people, and a guy was given the English name Ajemi. The Stono Rebellions in South Carolina was all about escaping, not rising up against slavery in South Carolina, but it was about escaping and going to Florida, to Fort Mosey, where other Africans had escaped from South Carolina and Georgia during the War of Jenkins era, they called it, between Spain and England. Spain said, if you run away and come to Florida, we'll give you your freedom. And many did, and including the so-called Stono Rebellion, which was branded an uprising, a slave uprising by the South Carolinian colonists, was actually an attempt by the Ashanti to run away to Florida for their freedom to establish an African colony in all measure. And that was called Fort Mosey, and many did. As a matter of fact, ironically, during the American Revolution, many of the black Floridians from that fort who remained in Florida fought with the Spaniards against the British during the American Revolution.
Okay. Getting back to Pap Singleton, what are some of the black settlements that he was responsible for finding here or founding here in the United States?
Yes.
That may still have a legacy today, that are still in existence.
Yes, in Topeka, Kansas, and various places in what's Emporia today, those were all Pap Singleton's colonies, so to speak. In Kansas, and they're still there. They're still there. Mm-hmm. He was also played an important role in colonizing Nicodemus, Kansas, which is a national historic site. Working mm-hmm. with Reverend Simon Roundtree to promote the settlement to people who were called Exodusters, leaving the.
Where did that term come from? Were they kicking up a lot of dust? Exodusters.
Yes, Exodus, and it's dusty in the way.
Oh, Exodus, okay, biblical connotation there.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry, Professor, go ahead.
Pap Singleton was often called the Moses of this Exodus movement.
Oh, yeah. He testified before Congress, didn't he, in 1880 or so, 1879, about his involvement with the movement?
Yes.
Yeah, they were very concerned, it seemed.
Well, what was happening, and you see the Exodus movement reaching a crescendo after 1877 through 1879, and that those are significant years. 1877 was the end of Reconstruction in the South and the withdrawal of federal troops. And during that time, with the withdrawal of federal troops, there was no longer protection against the white backlash that followed the American Revolution. I mean, the American Civil War, and the withdrawal of federal troops. So African Americans recognized what was happening and saw the increase in violence and oppression. And sought to leave during that time. So you saw a mass movement leaving between 1877 and 1879, and Pap Singleton was a part of that. It got to the point where whites when African Americans went to say board a riverboat like Natchez, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee. They were met by white mobs to prevent them from boarding those ships, those boats. And what was happening was the white landowners in the South were losing their labor. And to prevent that, they saw this exodus as a loss of labor. And so they tried everything they could to prevent that from occurring.
So is this what got Congress involved relative to bringing Singleton in to testify and trying to figure out who was behind this movement? Did they want to stop it?
Well, yeah, I think clearly in the South there were several state legislatures that passed laws to stop it and started things like debt peonage and so forth, where you had to borrow money for seeds and plows and supplies, and you never got out of debt, so therefore you could never leave until you paid the debt peonage. You had these kind of things happening. Congress
slavery by another name, huh?
Yes, that happened far too often in the South, in order to keep the black labor there and basically in a different type of slavery. And it's often been called debt servitude. Congress, unfortunately, was becoming more and more disinterested in interfering with what was happening in the South. They were basically withdrawing. After 1877, slowly over the course of a decade, Congress lost all interest in pursuing any further civil rights, justice, or equality for African Americans in the South, and it got worse in the 1890s. So Congress had very little interest in this. But where the interest was primarily in the South, seeing a depleting workforce leave for the West. And also, there was some interest in some of these land companies and how they were acquiring land and then selling it off to others. In Kansas, there was please forgive me, I'm drawing a blank on the two Kansas senators who were involved in some of these land deals under the pretext of reconstructing the Native American groups that were living in Kansas. And so during this time you saw many of the Native Americans who were removed from the American Southeast during Andrew Jackson's time.
During the 1830s.
Yeah.
Yeah, the trail where they cried.
Yeah, there was a second Trail of Tears following the Civil War under the pretext of reconstructing Native American tribes who fought for the Confederacy, and basically grabbing their land and forcing them into a second Trail of Tears. And so there was a lot of interest in Western land companies, and there really wasn't any interest in the federal government. There was some interest. Don't get me wrong. There was some interest.
Yeah.
There were still African Americans who were members of Congress at this time, even though that was starting to lose membership. There were still some members of Congress who had interest in racial justice and equality, but those numbers were dwindling. And so there was very, very little interest in listening to someone like Pap Singleton arguing for black labor to leave the South and go West. That's basically how the Southerners saw that.
Now, was Singleton a mixed blood person himself? And you said was he born in Virginia or Tennessee?
Tennessee.
Tennessee. What do we know about his early life?
He was born into slavery. And I really don't know if there was mixed heritage there. It would not surprise me if it was. That was not unusual in the South to have mixed racial heritage, Native American, European, and African. So that would not surprise me if that was the case.
You mentioned settlements like in Topeka and Nicodemus. If we were to go to Nicodemus today, what could we expect to see?
It's a National Historic Site and operated by the National Park Service. And what you see is reconstruction, trying to preserve what was left and to reconstruct that history of that community, Nicodemus. The other communities are still communities. You know, they're parts of Topeka, Kansas, and such. And a place called Tennessee Town and Emporia. Those communities still exist. And even if you go into other places in the West, those settlements are still there, despite attempts like to force the communities out. There were many attempts to force the communities out. Like in Oklahoma with Black Wall Street and during 1920.
Black Wall Street was in Arkansas, wasn't it? No, you're right. That was Oklahoma, Black Wall Street. Yeah, outside of Tulsa.
About 600 businesses were burned out during the 1920s, but you know the fortitude of people stayed, and endured. So despite that, you still see the communities enduring today, left over.
Were there any settlements established in Missouri that you're aware of? Or anywhere else in the Midwest? Which would include Oklahoma.
Like,
but at that time, it would have been Indian Territory.
Well, you know, like in Black Wall Street in Tulsa, and there are places in Texas. It doesn't exist, but there was an attempt in Texas to create what was called Yoruba land, and to establish a Black Yoruba colony or community in Texas. Some of these were clearly, looking at the name places, were attempts to recreate. Many could not afford the passage back to West Africa, So short of that, Pap Singleton, like many others, tried to create those African communities in the West. So you saw places like Yorubaland, places like that. As a matter of fact, even before then, the Dismal Swamp in Virginia was enslaved African Americans went into the Dismal Swamp and created African kingdoms, for that matter, in those areas, because they knew they couldn't get back to Africa, so they tried to create those communities there.
Could you explain to us what you mean by Dismal Swamp?
That's a place in Virginia, and it's a place where it's basically the name, I think, aptly describes it. It was a place where enslaved Africans would run away from their slave owners in Virginia and go out into the swamp, and they created communities there, and which to the white slave owners was a threat to them as slave owners, because as long as that place existed, and it existed for I'm guessing about 100 years. George Washington even contemplated sending a military expedition in to wipe them out. Eventually, they were those settlements were eradicated. But you know, you had kings elected in the Dismal Swamp. Same thing occurred in Georgia after the American Revolution. There were Africans who joined the British after the war. They were not evacuated. What they did, they created African communities in Georgia, and all of these posed threats to the white slave owners, who saw that, well, if they could retain these communities, then our enslaved Africans could potentially run off and join these communities and then bring the whole system down.
You mentioned George Washington. Did that have anything to do with the hemp scheme? And did he own the this swamp area?
He was a part of land companies that owned quite a bit of land. I think I'm not sure about the Dismal Swamp. However, I do know that posed a threat to the slave owners in Virginia, as long as those what were called maroon societies existed in that Dismal Swamp. They would go out and forage occasionally, and then raid some of the plantations and take livestock and that sort of thing, and then disappear back in the swamps, and nobody could track them down. They were safe haven to any runaways who would go there.
Were they trying to dredge out the hemp from that swamp, and we put them in competition with the tobacco growers?
I'm not familiar with that. I really don't know. I don't know. It's possible. Hemp at the time was mainly grown for rope, but it's possible. I really don't know.
Okay. Now,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, moving on from Pap Singleton, I guess the next movement was the American Colonization Society, which you mentioned earlier.
This movement to
Liberia.
Yeah, that predated Pap Singleton, the American Colonization Society, even though...
Okay, was that a Mr. Coppinger out of Washington? Was he the manager? A gentleman by the name of Coppinger?
That's not ringing a bell. The American Colonization Society was mainly decentralized to the state and local level. So you had branches throughout the primarily American South. There were some attempts in the post Civil War period to continue that migration to Liberia, but it really that movement fizzled through the American Colonization Society. It really fizzled. It got picked up, however, by people like Henry Highland Garnett, who was an advocate, strong advocate for colonization to Liberia, Haiti, or even Canada, for that matter, like William Delaney, who also advocated back to Africa, but short of that, African colonies or settlements in America, in particular Canada. You saw many Underground Railroad escaping slaves moving into Canada, forming communities there and remaining there to this day. And Martin Delaney was one of the advocates to go to Nigeria, or short of that, to Canada or American West. Henry Highland Garnett was really, I think, the leader in the Back to Africa movement following the American Civil War. And even Frederick Douglass, who was not a strong proponent for the Back to Africa movement, did see some benefits in African Americans moving to Haiti, where he was consular there. But it's really Henry Highland Garnett who's picking up the mantle after the Civil War, and eventually he became consular to Liberia, where he died in 1881 and was buried there.
The Fugitive Slave Act, how did this figure into our discussion here? Was that a motivator?
The Fugitive Slave Act was part of Compromise of 1850. Henry Clay pushed the Compromise of 1850 to try to keep the country together following the Mexican War. As you know, the Mexican War added a considerable amount of land to the United States adjacent to the Louisiana Purchase. The Fugitive Slave Act was a part of the compromise in order to secure laws favorable to the North, and this was a compromise to the Southern slave owners who were saying that slaves were running away to the North and they were given their freedom. They were not returned back, and anyone sent to the North to retrieve the runaways were met with mob violence, like Oberlin, Ohio, where slave catchers had come up to retrieve a runaway, and the students and professors and the people of Oberlin, Ohio, famous rescue of one of the runaway slaves. In Pennsylvania, there was an outright war almost when slave owners came across to try to break up free black community. So the Fugitive Slave Act made it a responsibility for all citizens to return any runaway slave to their slave owners in the South. As a matter of fact, marshals had the power to deputize anyone to help in that effort. It was deplored by Northerners. They hated that law and resisted it every opportunity they could. But it was an attempt to stop these runaways. And some of the runaways were running away into Western territories, and where they were seeking refuge among Native American tribes. Some even ran to Mexico, and we still have some fugitive communities, black communities in Mexico. There's still some remnants of that.
Can I stop you right there? I want to remind our listeners that they can call in with questions or comment at 949-270-9585. 5957. Our guest is Dr. Bradley Skelcher, Associate Professor, or Associate Provost, I'm sorry, and Professor of History at Delaware State University in Dover, Delaware. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host. You mentioned earlier Henry Clay. What was Henry Clay's involvement in the gold rush of 1849-1850?
I don't know if there's any direct any direct involvement of Henry Clay with the gold rush, but what the gold rush did do was it led to a movement in California for statehood. There was a massive increase in population, and many of the senators from states east of the Mississippi were calling for Congress to admit California as a state in order to establish law and order and all that sort of thing. That Henry Clay included California coming into the Union as a free state in the Compromise of 1850. The goal.
But they were.
Yeah.
They were to be admitted, though, in exchange, or as a free state in exchange for any fugitive, any slave fugitive.
In essence, that's what it meant, because the fugitive slave law in 1850 meant that if any slave ran away to California, that slave would have to be returned to the slave owner. So that's essentially what it amounted to. In exchange for statehood, that's one part of it. And as a free state, I might add, the other part of that compromise was Fugitive Slave Act, 1850. So, in essence, that's what it meant.
The Fugitive Slave Law is the grandpappy of the industrial prison complex that we are experiencing today, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, that's basically what you're talking about. You're talking about unfree labor running away from the plantation slave system, and the Fugitive Slave Act was a law that required Northerners who bitterly opposed slavery to participate in the protection of it. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, it gave monetary benefits to the common people for rounding up slaves and making bounty hunters out of them.
It's against their will, and that was the disgusting part of it. People were forced to into this, which led to the Overland riot against slave catchers trying to retrieve, and it used the U.S. federal marshal system to be slave catchers. And so you had U.S. Marshals being forced into retrieving runaway slaves and bringing them back, and then facing Northerners who were barely opposed to it and saying, I'm deputizing you to be a part of this. So it was one of those laws that the North was disgusted with, and you can argue accelerated the movement towards the fracture between and the American Civil War. You know, the 1850 compromise was intended to keep the country together, but you can argue by the end of the decade it accelerated the split in the country, rather than dealing with slavery at the time and saying that, you know, you could not basically. It overturned the Missouri Compromise, which said slavery shall not exist before above 38 degree parallel, something like that. That with the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Dred Scott decision, nullified any attempt to stop the extension of slavery into the Western territories. And Lincoln, that was his position. He was opposed to extension of slavery in the territories, and then you had all this other stuff going on that ran counter to it, leading essentially ultimately to the American Civil War.
Okay. Our listeners might be interested to know that Judge Riker in New York City, that Riker's Island is its name for, was a benefactor of that particular movement. And
you can argue all Americans to this day are benefactors to the wealth produced by American slaves in the South. You can take all of the wealth in the country before the American Civil War, and it did not add up to the wealth of the slave system in the South. And that led to the prosperity in the Industrial Revolution and so forth, and the economic power of the United States government. You can directly trace that to the economic power of American slavery in the South, no question about it. So Americans to this day are still benefactors of that system economically.
Oh, so that was a forerunner of the convict leasing system.
Oh, yeah.
That was introduced later on.
Well, you can find Frederick Douglass was leased out. He was enslaved on the eastern shore of Maryland, not far from Dover, and his owners on the eastern shore, there was no longer a demand for labor, slave labor, or any kind of labor. They were moving towards a more capital-intensive production of grain. So many slaves were sold south, illegally, I might add. It was illegal to trade slaves out of the state of Maryland, but they did it anyway, to points south and southwest. Frederick Douglass was sent to Baltimore, where he was hired out to work in the shipbuilding industry. He was a caulker for these what were called Baltimore Clippers. The same as the Amistad was aboard Baltimore Clipper, and so he was hired out to do that. You saw that occurring throughout the South, but in particular in the Chesapeake region, where they were either sold south or hired out because the tobacco plant labor intensive tobacco production was fading and being replaced by capital-intensive production of grains. So, that was quite common practice during that time.
Our readers might be interested in
that. You can argue that, the prison hiring system, it wasn't just invented recently. You can trace that back a long way, too.
Yeah, our readers might be interested in a book by Douglas Blackman called Slavery by Another Name.
Uh-huh.
It traces that from the fugitive slave law into the convict leasing system, the privatization of prisons today, the juvenile detention centers, et cetera.
I think we have to be very careful when we see and be vigilant when we see these things occurring. That we'd be very, very careful when we see these types of convict labor systems emerge. There are international agreements against this. I mean, we're criticizing China for prison labor and so forth. So there are conventions against a lot of these practices and such for. If they're moving beyond, training and providing vocational skills and such, and these kind of things, I know there's movements around the country for this kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of reminded, the stop and frisk laws that you see in a lot of communities or activities, I should say, are kind of reminders of the black codes. that came out of that fugitive slave act back in the day.
Racial profiling and those
racial
kinds.
Profiling, et cetera. Coming forward here, the Black Back to Africa movement, the national or Black nationalism in the 19th century. Could you go into that a bit for us?
What many call the Pan-Africanist, which or back to Africa movement or back nationalist, Black nationalism that grew up and basically provided the inspiration for Marcus Garvey, actually, in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. Marcus Garvey gained his inspiration from people like Henry Turner, Alexander Cromwell, Edward Blyden.
Who was Henry Turner? Do you have a radio on there, Professor?
No.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Who was Henry Turner?
He eventually rose to leadership in American Colonization Society in the 19th century. A proponent of Pan-Africanism.
Okay, and you were mentioning making reference to Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey was inspired by these Pan-Africanists. In the United States, well, Blyden was actually from the Caribbean, West Indies too, and he was inspired by what they were doing and created this Back to Africa movement chartered the Black Star Line, which was chartered in Delaware, by the way, bought ships. From Wilmington, Delaware, ship owner, even though he was headquartered in New York City, Delaware played an important role in the chartering of the Black Star Line in selling the ships. All of which was an attempt to go to Africa and create an empire, an African empire, a unified African empire. And for a place for African Americans, disenfranchised African Americans to leave, to go to a place where they could achieve success, upward mobility, equality, and so forth. A strong appeal to the disenfranchised African American people in the United States at that time. And he gained his inspiration, believe it or not, from people like Booker T. Washington, who many of your readers may not be aware, but Booker T. Washington founded funded many of these movements and independence nationalist movements in Africa, who would come to study at Tuskegee and take that back to Africa, and he also, without much fanfare, supported these movements. And so, you know, you got Marcus Garvey gaining his inspiration. And it's also been noted that when Marcus Garvey visited the Panama Canal and saw the oppression, the oppressive labor abuse of West Indians there, that he saw that there was essential to go back to Africa and create an independent society there that could sustain itself and to prosper, that it wasn't happening in the Americas. That was much of his dream, and a dream for many African Americans as well, that it just wasn't happening here. And Du Bois was a part of the Pan-African movement.
Are you familiar with Timbuktu in New Jersey and New York?
No, I'm not. I must confess.
Okay. Now, what happened to Marcus Garvey eventually? The feds confiscated his ships, and did he do any time in prison? Did he convict him of anything? What was the story on that?
He was arrested, charged, and convicted for mail fraud. He was using the United States mails to solicit investors in the Black Star Lines, and he was exiled back to deported to Jamaica. That's where he spent his last years in Jamaica with his wife.
Was it true that he attempted to form alliances with the Ku Klux Klan? Did you ever hear anything about that?
No, I'm not aware of that. No, I haven't read anything or heard anything about that.
Okay. Now Garvey himself, he was West Indian, wasn't he?
Yes, Jamaica.
Okay, from Jamaica. And so he was sent there in exile.
Well, I said exile, but I meant to say he was deported back to Jamaica.
Deported back to Jamaica. Did he die there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And does he have descendants
living today? I presume so. He had children, and I presume that they're still living. I couldn't say one way or the other, but yeah, he had a family.
What books would you suggest to our readers for information on Black settlements, the Back to Africa movement, any documentaries? We're coming up to a close now, so do you have any information for our listeners reference to good books and literature on Black settlements and the Back to Africa movement?
Nell Painter.
Mel Painter.
Nell okay. Irvin Painter. N-E-L-L Irvin, I-R-V-I-N, Painter, P-A-I-N-T-E-R.
Oh. Okay.
She wrote, well, she's written several books, and one of the books is actually titled Exoduster, and it's about the movement led by Pap Singleton to settle the West. So that's probably the most important work done on the subject by Nell Painter. I'm trying to think if she's still. No, she's retired. She's retired. She was at Princeton University for many years. I believe before Princeton, she may have been at New York University, but don't quote me on that.
What historical towns should we put on our tourist bucket list?
I would definitely go to Nicodemus. There's there's a place in California north of Bakersfield. It was founded by Colonel Allensworth in 1908, and I'm drawing a blank on the name. I believe the original name was Allensworth, California. But it's
Allensworth, California. Okay.
Yeah, it's a state historic site, and it was founded by an Army veteran named Lieutenant Colonel Allensworth, and they built the town just north of about 45 miles north of Bakersfield, and the site now is Earl and Mark, California. That was a similar African American community. It's a state historic site now, built right on the Southern Pacific Rail line, and similar to other All Black settlements. I met the group that was in charge of what's now basically a historic site and museum a few years ago, and it's very. I would recommend that site. For all purposes, what many call the Black metropolis of Chicago, the southern part of Chicago, South Side Chicago, I would highly recommend because when African Americans were moving north from Mississippi, Alabama, they were moving into South Chicago and created what, by all essence, is an African community in Chicago. It was independent. It was built and founded and settled in, to create an African American community in that urban environment. And for many respects, that's a part of that movement out in a place that everyone should go, I think.
Oh yeah, Maxwell Street in Chicago was part of that. Was a main thoroughfare there through the south side of Chicago.
Exactly.
Maxwell Street.
North Buxton in Ontario
Canada. Okay.
In Canada, it's a wonderful place. There's a direct relationship with the people living there, and this part of the country in Wilmington, Delaware. Many of the settlers, many people from this area are still living. Their relatives are still living there. North Buxton, Ontario, I think it's a terminus on the Underground Railroad. I highly recommend that. And there's a whole Ontario West African American trail, heritage trail, that you can buy maps and just drive cars around to see the various African American settlements in Canada, in Ontario West. And I highly recommend that.
I'm not familiar with that part of the country. From what part of the United States would you enter Ontario? Would that be through Detroit or?
Yeah, I would suggest going across from Detroit over to Windsor, and then you can go online and just type in Underground Railroad in Ontario West and Canada, and you can get all the sites. And I believe Parks Canada has tour maps that you can pick up and go to these sites. And I'm sure there are telephone numbers and contacts that you can call ahead. There's a place called Walls in Canada where a family named Walls escaped there, and they have a museum and a site. Uncle Tom's Cabin, believe it or not, is a real place in Canada. So you can see these sites, and Canada promotes these sites through Park Canada. I would also for more recent history go to Topeka, Kansas, and visit the Brown v. Board National Historic Site. It's a Park Service, National Park Service site in Topeka, Kansas.
So a lot of these can be contacted through the National Park Service.
Absolutely. If you go to...
Get to their website.
NPS.gov, type in African American historic sites, and they'll come up. And you can even go to one of the web pages at the National Park Service, and they'll provide a travel itinerary for you.
Okay.
You don't even have to go to a travel agent. It's all there, and you can do various itinerary themes. You want Black settlements in the West? You can type that in, and it can give you an itinerary. Underground Railroad tours, you can type that in, it'll give you an itinerary. So that I would highly recommend the listeners to go to the National Park Service, and they'll give you a full listing of all of these sites and a brief history, hours, that operation hours, lodging, all sorts of things. And the same with Parks Canada, to type those in. And
okay. And if any of our listeners would want to contact you, Professor, to carry, if they have questions or comments, and how would they do that?
My email, my first name is Bradley and last name Skelcher. University email address is B, my first initial, first name, B, and my last name, Skelcher, at desu.edu. That's probably the best way. And then I can answer any questions and attach information or links to websites and such. I can put together a larger bibliography for anyone who wants to read additional work. And I might add that going to those National Park Service sites, they'll also give you a reading list of major historians who cover these. I was just recently in St. Louis, Missouri, at a conference, and the hotel was right next to the St. Louis Courthouse. That's where the Dred Scott decision
decision was made. Yes.
That's where it was first heard. So I would put St. Louis, Missouri on that itinerary, and the old St. Louis Courthouse. I was just there, and they have also a wonderful bookstore where you can pick up a lot of civil rights history. And
there at that courthouse, excuse me, Professor, at that courthouse in St. Louis, do they still reenact slave sales on the steps there?
That I don't know, but I would contact them and see if they do that. I really don't know. I would suspect that they would reenact the court case there where Dred Scott sued.
Yeah, the Dred Scott decision. Okay.
I would recommend that. Going there, there's just so many places in the West that have African American history associated with that those particular sites, and it's just a wealth of places. And in Illinois, I know there were freedom communities from runaways going into Illinois, and they established free communities there because it was safe for them. Just all over, it's just a wealth of history. And I know we're coming to the end of summer, but I would highly recommend next summer just getting in the car and just driving and visiting these sites. It's just an experience all Americans should have, and to experience what freedom's all about in the quest for freedom.
My producers are telling me that we're also coming to the end of our show here. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing there relative to African American history. And we've been in company with Dr. Bradley Skelcher, who's an associate provost and professor of history at the Delaware State University in Dover, Delaware, and HBCU.
Yes.
Really appreciate the work there, Doctor. And
well,
perhaps
thank you
we can have you. Perhaps we could have you on again.
I would. It would be my pleasure. Be my pleasure.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Thank you.